Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour, we'll talk about the protests, those that were violent in Libya, resulting in the death of Ambassador Chris Stevens, three other Americans, and probably more than 10 Libyans dying in that attack. Also, protests in Egypt, and as you heard on the news from NPR just a few moments ago, protests in Yemen, where the American embassy has been stormed as well. Hillary Clinton said yesterday, "Today many Americans are asking, indeed I ask myself, how could this happen? How could this happen in a country we helped liberate, in a city we helped save from destruction? This question reflects just how complicated and at times how confounding the world can be. But we must be clear-eyed even in our grief. This was an attack by a small and savage group, not the people or the government of Libya." Our guest this hour has written extensively and reported extensively from this part of the world. Lindsay Hilsum is the international editor for Britain's Channel 4 News. She appears regularly on PBS NewsHour and CNN and has covered major conflicts and international events for the past 20 years, the wars in Iraq, Kosovo, Afghanistan, as well as the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, the genocide in Rwanda, and she spent the last year reporting from Egypt, Bahrain, and Libya, where she covered the revolt against Colonel Gaddafi's 42-year rule. She is the author of Sandstorm, Libya in the Time of Revolution. We'll be welcoming phone calls during the course of our conversation. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page, if you'd like to leave messages there, is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Lindsay Hilsum, thank you very much for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
Since the attacks that resulted in the death of Chris Stevens and others in Libya, there were protests, of course, in Egypt, and today we're hearing about the storming of the American embassy in Yemen. Are all of these related to this film, or are they each individual incidents with individual grievances in each country?
Well, I think that the film has certainly been a catalyst, and I think that particularly in Cairo, in Egypt, and in Sana'a, in Yemen, it has got the mob out, and people are angry about it. But I think that the attack on the U.S. consulate in Benghazi yesterday was rather different. There was a mob there protesting, but also there were heavily armed men in black jeeps calling themselves Ansar al-Sharia, that means followers of Islamic law, and they fired a rocket-propelled grenade into the consulate. Now, I think that the U.S. government is following up a line which suggests that this was a planned attack. It wasn't a spontaneous outburst of anger about the film. It seems that the crowd protesting about the film may have really just been a smokescreen, and people who were planning an attack, jihadis following a similar ideology to al-Qaeda, took advantage of that.
Mm-hmm. This one of the reports yesterday said that Stevens, Ambassador Stevens, was the victim of a targeted al-Qaeda revenge attack. Is that what you're seeing in your sources?
Well, that's one possibility. Ayman al-Zawahiri, who is the man who took over as the head of al-Qaeda after Osama bin Laden was killed, he put out a video saying that Libyans should avenge the death of another Libyan, a man called Abu Yahya al-Libi, who was the number two to al-Zawahiri, a senior member of al-Qaeda. Now, I should stress that the majority of Libyans hate al-Qaeda and have nothing to do with it. But there are a group of Libyans, and I wouldn't be able to say how many, they're particularly concentrated in the east of the country, who do follow a similar ideology to al-Qaeda. And it is possible that this was them doing what al-Zawahiri said, taking revenge for the death of this man, Abu Yahya al-Libi.
You have said, and you just said it now, that many Libyans are appreciative of America and of Western support, but you've also said, I suspect that will be short-lived. Islamists are on the rise, and they tend to be anti-Western.
Yeah, I think that Libya, in a strange way, you know, Libya is more pro-American than any of the other countries. And, you know, people may be surprised to hear that. But Libya is a small population, about 6 million people. Many Libyans have studied in America, and some have studied in Britain as well. And there isn't a groundswell of anti-Americanism, which there certainly is in Egypt. And some have spent in Egypt. There's lots of people who hate the Americans and who have a much more kind of Islamist ideology. But in Libya, large numbers of people really love America. And in fact, there have been pro-American demonstrations on the streets of Tripoli and Benghazi over the last couple of days. A Libyan friend of mine put up on Facebook, "I'm no longer proud to be a Libyan." He was so ashamed by what happened, by the death of Chris Stevens. And others I know feel that really these jihadis represent a very small minority. But the issue is that the government has not established law and order.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as there is no law and order, there is no proper police force, no proper army, then the men with guns, the extremists, will prevail. And the Libyan government obviously has to take some responsibility for failing to protect the U.S. consulate.
You cite last month the interior minister saying that he wouldn't intervene to stop these kinds of groups from attacking Sufi shrines because it was not worth sacrificing any lives to protect a grave. You go on to say this seems to be what emboldened them.
Yes, because what's been happening is that these groups of extremists have been demolishing Sufi shrines. These are sacred to many Libyan Muslims. And they are also, even the Libyans who don't see them as sacred, regard them as part of their heritage. But the Salafists, the extremists with the Al-Qaeda-style ideology, see the shrines as idolatrous. You know, they're like the Puritans back in the 16th century who went round England destroying, you know, pictures of the Virgin Mary and so on. It's a very similar kind of ideology. But because the Ministry of the Interior was weak, and because maybe some of the people within that ministry sympathized with the extremists, they did nothing to stop these extremists from destroying the shrines. Well, that was a sign, wasn't it? That was a sign of encouragement that no one's going to stop them, and no one stopped them when they attacked the U.S. consulate either. So this is the moment which is a real test for the Libyan government, because the U.S. government has been a big friend to the Libyan government. The U.S., you know, they supported the revolution of overthrowing Gaddafi, and I think that a lot of Libyans understand very well what Hillary Clinton meant when she said, you know, how on earth could it happen,
right,
that the U.S. ambassador could lose his life in the city which he had helped save.
Mm-hmm. I know, it stops you in your tracks, doesn't it? It's just terrible. Why is the Libyan government having problems asserting its authority? Are there a lot of people in the government who may sympathize with these kinds of acts, or are they just not ready to go yet, or what is it?
Well, I think it's more the history, and you know, this is one of the things which I try and explain in the book. I mean, for 42 years, power really resided with one man, Colonel Gaddafi. He was the spider at the center of the web. And then when he went, you know, the entire web collapsed. It was year zero. There were no institutions. There was nothing. And so the people who are in charge now, they have no experience of governing. They have no experience of making decisions. No one was allowed to make a decision. Many of them have come from overseas. The man who was prime minister, interim prime minister, he was a lecturer in electrical engineering at Michigan State University. So, you know, they have absolutely no experience, and at the moment they are totally failing to govern, to be able to get the weapons back from the different militia and to create a proper national army and police force. So that's the big challenge to them. They have to learn how to govern very, very quickly.
The President of the United States has talked about the fact that there will be a response to this. There are ships in the area right now. What do you recommend in terms of a response to this action? How can America respond, and should America respond?
Well, I'm a journalist, not an advisor to the American government, so
right.
I would hesitate before giving any advice. What I would say is that it's not easy, but you know, everybody knows who these people are. The Libyans know who these people are, and maybe it's really the Libyan government which has to rein them in. Now, I'm told that there is some kind of military operation which is either starting today or in the next few days in the east of the country. There's a place called Derna, which is a town east of Benghazi, and that is where some of the jihadists are supposed to hang out. I've been there. I've seen the black flags, which are the Al-Qaeda-style Islamist flag, flying there. But, of course, you know, the danger with all of these operations is that you go for these group of men, but they're hiding in amongst the community, and the danger is that then you end up killing women and children as well and creating resentment amongst the local population. So that's the difficulty anybody who is trying to curtail these men is gonna come across.
And yet the U.S. ambassador was killed in Benghazi, and so you expect that the United States will take some kind of action.
Yeah, I'm sure the United States will want to take some kind of action, but I presume that they want to take some kind of effective action, and that is really the most difficult thing.
Mm-hmm. You've talked about your view following our experiences in Iraq and also Afghanistan. Western countries need to take a back seat. It's up to Libyans to make this work. When you talk about a back seat, what do you mean?
Well, what I mean is that I think this is one of the lessons of Iraq, isn't it? That the U.S. and Britain intervened in Iraq, and then, you know, they occupied the place, and that just didn't work. And the occupation of Afghanistan hasn't been a raging success either, has it? So the idea of this is that really the Americans or NATO helped to overthrow a dictator, but occupation always leads to resentment. So now I think it really does have to be the Libyans who sort themselves out. But, you know, I have a great deal of sympathy with, you know, with Americans who would say, well, you know, now we're going to back right off because, you know, this is the thanks that we get. And the Libyans who I know, the Libyans who I've, you know, become friends with over time, they are highly, you know, they're well-educated. They know what they want. But it's a question of making the systems and the institutions work. That they really do have to do themselves. America can't do it for them.
You have a rare perspective because you were in Benghazi during the revolution. And I'd like to get a better sense of how strong the feeling is among Libyans to make this work and how important this revolution was.
Oh, this revolution was transformative. This revolution was a moment in a generation. Dictatorship for 42 years. I mean, there were people who had known nothing but dictatorship. But this, we're talking about a globalized world, and we're talking about a generation which have grown up watching satellite television. You can't, you know, pull the wool over their eyes. They know what the world is like out there. And we're also talking about a place which is wealthy. It has oil and a very small population, only 6 million people. So many Libyans, they're very highly connected with the rest of the world. They're not, you know, people living in the desert with no idea of what's going on elsewhere. Far from it. The danger is that the better educated Libyans, the ones who can, you know, really essential for the making of a modern state, if things continue down the track that they are, if there is violence and disorder and extremists basically taking control, then many of them will leave because they're very employable elsewhere. They can get good jobs in Dubai. Many of them have the rights to live in America or Britain. So I think that there isn't there's a window for this to work. And that window is going to probably close within a year, I would say. They really do have to get themselves sorted.
We welcome phone calls. We have several of them coming in already. Lindsay Hilsum is our guest. Her book is Sandstorm, Libya in the Time of Revolution. She was in Benghazi during the time of the revolution, and she's a top-notch foreign correspondent who has spent much of her reporting time in the Middle East. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I guess for more of this show, and then we'll switch to another guest, is Lindsay Hilsum, international editor for Britain's Channel 4 News. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. Rick in Milwaukee, hi.
Good morning to you, Kathleen, and to your guest. The story that just came out a few days ago is that this president has not attended something like 50% of his daily security briefings prepared specifically for him by the Central Intelligence Agency. And in the week before this atrocity, he didn't attend a single one. Now, the guy has a profound lack of interest in the security affairs of the country that he's supposed to be governing, and it really parallels his lack of interest also in the American economy.
Which president are you talking about?
The one we got in the White House right now.
All right, you're going to put politics right in the center of this. Do you want to respond to that?
Well, I'm not an expert on American politics. I'm here because I know about Libya. But I think, you know, all I can say is, you know, we see the difficulty that George Bush, who was a Republican, had when trying to deal with the fallout of the invasion in Iraq. And now we see the difficulty that President Obama is having in Libya. These are complex and difficult situations. I suspect it's just as difficult for Republicans as it is for Democrats. Nobody there has a monopoly on being able to know exactly how to handle these complex situations.
And let's go beyond Libya for just a moment and look at Egypt and look at what's going on in Yemen today. Is this, as some commentators have said, the result of people trying to figure out how to govern themselves, the Arab Spring, and a rise in many of these countries of Islamist militants? What's causing all of that? Will we see more of those? How do we respond to that? Do we just take a hands-off approach?
It's very difficult. I mean, in Yemen and Egypt, it does seem to be a popular reaction to this film, which insults the Prophet Muhammad more than an organized jihadi type attack, which is what I think we saw in Libya yesterday. But one of the things that's interesting is the role of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. We see President Morsi, who is a Muslim Brotherhood president from Egypt, in Europe today in Brussels, and he's basically trying to tread this line because he's, on the one hand, he wants to be friends with Europe. He needs American support and American money. On the other hand, there is a fairly radicalized base which is quite anti-American, and those are many, many millions of people. Egypt has a huge population. So, and he, again, is an inexperienced politician. So we see him trying to straddle these two sides, and I'm not sure that he's doing it completely successfully. The Muslim Brotherhood have called for demonstrations, peaceful demonstrations, against the film tomorrow after Friday prayers. Well, calling for peaceful demonstrations at this phase, that's very difficult because demonstrations very rarely remain peaceful in Egypt. And I noticed that the American embassy in Cairo put out a rather sharp tweet earlier, where they said, "Muslim Brotherhood, please note, we are following what you're saying in Arabic as well as in English." Now, I don't know what they've been saying in Arabic, but that would indicate that there may be two messages going on, a much more radical anti-American message in Arabic and a more mollifying message in English.
Let's go to Habu in Madison. Hello, Habu.
Good morning, and thank you. I'm watching with a little bit of bemusement the events unfolding in Libya, not because this isn't tragic, but because there have been many, many more killed, about 30,000 Libyans who were lost in this whole changeover. And my question really goes to why are we not surprised? This happened in Afghanistan. It happened in Iraq. You know, when the change was occurring, the intelligence agencies of Western nations, but especially the United States, were fully aware of these jihadi types who were being imported into Libya to bring about change. And coincidentally, many of these are going into Syria now. So to take down some nation who had a dictator, perhaps a benign one, and then expect results which are different is madness. my question to you is this. It seems that the Benghazi region, which is in the eastern part of the nation, is also close to the oil fields, and they want almost complete autonomy. And there have been these troubling things occurring, like, you know, raising down some shrines, religious shrines, and also executions, etc. So would you please shed some light on this? Thank you.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's a number of interesting points that you raise there. I mean, one thing I have to pull you up on is this issue of a dictator who was in some way benign. I don't think that Gaddafi was benign. I don't think that the 1,270 men who were murdered in one day in Abu Salim prison in 1996 by the Gaddafi regime, I don't think their families would regard him as benign. He certainly was a very cruel dictator. One of the complexities, and there are many complexities here, is that his enemies were jihadis. And after 9/11, our governments, the British and the Americans, MI6 and the CIA, collaborated very closely with Gaddafi. Extraordinary rendition occurred. Libyans who had fought in Afghanistan were rendered back to Libya by the CIA and MI6 and tortured in Libyan jails. And some of what we're seeing is, you know, people don't forget about that kind of thing. That continues. And I think that, so you're absolutely right, that the American, British, French governments were well aware that there were some of these jihadis around in Libya. But, you know, Libyan society is varied like any other society. I have no doubt that the people who started the revolution were young people. They were a generation that wanted change. They were a globalized generation who were hoping for democracy. Now, those people have not as yet been able to assert themselves. And what is happening is that the jihadists who are, you know, when they have the weapons and they have this ideology, at the moment are trying to prevail. But the elections which you had in Libya about 6 weeks ago, I was there, when it came down to a vote, people voted for technocrats. They didn't vote for the extremist Islamists at all. So I think that this is the battle which we're going to see, the battle for the soul of the revolution. You could say this is the battle that we're going to see in the coming months and years.
Here's an email from Seth in Green Bay. Are these uprisings popular in the home countries that they are occurring in as well as around the rest of the Middle East? And can the U.S. and our allies expect the host countries to provide security, or is the U.S. government moving towards strengthening their security for diplomatic missions?
Well, the U.S. government certainly is strengthening its security for diplomatic missions, and I certainly think that there will be an inquiry as to why there wasn't more security for the consulate in Benghazi. After all, it was September the 11th, which is, of course, a very post-anniversary.
Yes.
And so one does wonder why, you know, I'm told there were about 40 guards there. Well, I mean, clearly that was not enough, and I'm sure that questions are going to be asked about that. They are increasing security now, and you know, with this anti-Islamic film going around, there could be anywhere in the Muslim world where you could start to get these kinds of attacks and protests. As to the first part of the question, yes, I do believe that these were popular uprisings, but you know, it's easier to be against something than it is to be for something. It's easy for everybody to unite against a dictator, Colonel Gaddafi. But Libyans have very different visions of the kind of Libya they want to create afterwards, and that's what's in play now, those different visions.
It's very hard, and help us understand this, to understand why these kinds of massive protests can take place over a film.
Yep, it is hard. Again, I was just I don't think that what happened in Libya was really about the film. I think
right,
that
not
was
in
just
Libya.
An excuse. But, yes, yeah. It is, but then, you know, it's not difficult to whip up a mob in all sorts of places, is it? I mean, we had riots in London last year. You can whip people up, and people are being whipped up. And I think that there also is a sense across in many places in the Arab world, in the Muslim world, this great anti-Americanism, and it comes out of, you know, the situation with Israel and the Palestinians and so many historical things, and people feel discriminated against. And so when you have those kinds of grievances, it's not difficult for leaders or for charismatic people to get a mob to commit violence.
And it doesn't seem to be easy either to lessen the anti-Americanism, does it?
No, it doesn't. It doesn't seem. And, you know, and this is a... But, you know, you look at all... People feel that, you know, the occupation of Iraq, that was a cause which many people in the Muslim world jumped onto. The drone strikes in Afghanistan and Pakistan. There are so many different things that have happened that, you know, the interpretation of many people across the Muslim world is that this is, you know, domination by the Americans, and it should be resisted.
Nate in Milwaukee. Hi, Nate.
Hi. Thanks for having me. I was going to throw a couple things out there. First is, there are a lot of armed groups that participated in the overthrow of Gaddafi. How far have they gone into coalescing into what could be either a national police force or national army? And this isn't Libya, but in Egypt, they would have a different president right now if the non-former regime and non-Muslim Brotherhood political parties had somehow worked out an internal primary system between themselves, because they would have actually then had most of the vote if they just concentrated it. Oh, and speaking of votes, sorry about an earlier caller. I suspect that was political rumor-mongering, and it may not be close to reality.
Right.
Yeah, no, good points, and I don't think you're responsible for the previous caller. But you ask how much the armed groups are coalescing into a national police and army. Well, the answer is clearly not enough, and that is one of the big challenges, that you have all these different militia, and they have refused to lay down their weapons, and the government has failed to disarm those different groups. And although there's a program to try and get them into a national army and police force, Libya is very fragmented, and that again is one of the one of the legacies of Gaddafi, that people are mistrustful of each other, regions are distrustful of each other, tribes are distrustful of each other, and so on. And so it's forging this national identity, which means also this national police force and army. That's one of the main challenges for the government, and they better get on with it quickly. Because what we saw yesterday is the result of them failing to do that. On Egypt, you're absolutely right that there were many different candidates for president. And I think that for many of the young people and the secular people who had demonstrated and called for the overthrow of President Mubarak, they were very disappointed that when it came down to the last two, well, it was the same old struggle between the Muslim Brotherhood and the candidate of the military. And because the what you might call the liberal or the progressive candidates, people had failed to come up with a single candidate, that was why they lost. So if they want to create the kind of Egypt which they said the revolution was for, well, they have to get organized.
Yeah.
They have to learn how to do politics, which they've manifestly failed to do.
Mm-hmm. And finally, getting back to the murder of this man who, by all accounts, from testimony from Libyans and from people who worked with him, the world needing more people like Chris Stevens, what about the demonstrations and sympathy that are supposedly to take place in Libya? Are those significant at all? Will they be significant? Will those be large?
I think that they are significant in the sense that they show how many Libyans you supported Chris Stevens and were grateful to the Americans for the intervention. And, you know, Chris Stevens was a man who, you know, he spoke Arabic, he knew a lot of people, he was very popular, particularly in Benghazi. And, you know, people are in mourning. They're in mourning for him, and they fear that they're in mourning for the kind of Libya they wanted to create. Because these demonstrations are important as, you know, they show a popular will. But unless that popular will is turned into something meaningful, in other words, the government establishing law and order and asserting itself, then the hopes of all those young people who fought for that revolution, those hopes are going to be dashed, and it's the Libya that they dreamed of that they're going to be mourning.
Thank you so much for all the work that you've done and for being with us. I appreciate your time, Lindsay.
It's a pleasure.
Lindsay Hilsum, she has a book on Libya, which, of course, becomes more important right now. Sandstorm, Libya in the time of revolution, more timely, I should say. It's not less important than it was a week ago or 2 weeks ago. And she has done a great deal of reporting. She joined us by phone from England, where she works for the Channel 4, but she has spent a great deal of time over the past 20 years covering the Middle East, the past major conflicts, actually, of the past two decades, the wars in Iraq, Kosovo, and Afghanistan, as well as the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and the genocide in Rwanda. In 2011, she reported from Egypt and Bahrain, as well as from Libya. We continue our conversation, and we'll welcome more of your phone calls. We have a different guest joining us the next part of the program, the Richard Borrow Fellow at the Washington Institute, Aaron Zellin. His research focuses on how jihadist groups are adjusting to the new political environment in the era of Arab uprisings and Salafi politics in countries transitioning to democracy, which is an important part of this whole discussion. Frequent contributor to Foreign Policy, Foreign Affairs, and the Atlantic, and co-author of the New America Foundation's forthcoming study, The State of the Global Jihad Online. We'll welcome phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and you can always put messages on Facebook. We'd like to hear from you there as well. And that is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Aaron, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Please tell me what you think. Let's start with Libya, where there was loss of life, the American ambassador, three other Americans, and evidently up to 12 Libyans were killed as well. When you looked at that and you look at it today, who was responsible for that?
Well, I think, there's been a variety of events in, Egypt, Libya, and Yemen, and I think that while many view these things as interconnected, I think it's important us to remember that the causes in each country are different. Mm-hmm. But turning to Libya, in that case, it appears as more information comes out that it was a premeditated attack because individuals, they started an assault and then they knew about the safe house for the consulate as well, and that they're there and ready with a variety of different types of weapons. At this point, there are three potential groups that might have been involved. It has not been confirmed yet either way. The first is this group called Katiba Ansar al-Sharia in Benghazi. It's a small Salafi jihadi group that was created after the uprisings in Libya. The second group is the imprisoned Umar Abdul Rahman Brigade, which was responsible for a series of attacks in May and June against the U.S. consulate in Benghazi, as well as British interests and the International Red Cross in Benghazi. And then the third one is that there are some reports from the government saying that it's al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. But based on some of the information that are coming out now, the Ansar al-Sharia group has denied ordering the attack, and there's not that much substance to the al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb reporting at this juncture. And based on the attacks that occurred in May and June from the imprisoned Umar Abdul Rahman Brigade, it is pointing to potentially being them at this point. At least that's the best that we can, available information that we have right now.
And obviously timed to strike on September 11th.
Yeah, I believe so. I definitely think that the anniversary was an important part of it, and that while there were some individuals that were protesting this alleged film in front of the consulate, they were peaceful, and these individuals sort of piggybacked off of that and then conducted the operation that they wanted to do anyways. And they sort of then used that as cover for what they were doing. And I think another thing that people should keep in mind with regard to this is that also the few days beforehand, it was confirmed that Ayman al-Zawahiri mentioned that, Abu Yahya al-Libi, who is a leader of al-Qaeda and a Libyan, died also. So I think that might be part of it as well.
Mm-hmm. And please tell me about the state of al-Qaeda right now. American officials have said that we have really made this a much smaller organization than it was. You look at these kinds of demonstrations that are taking place all over, and it makes you wonder, is it much smaller? Are these groups gaining in popularity?
Well, I think there's a few things going on. I do think that Al-Qaeda Central in Pakistan is very weak, if not close to being completely defeated. They really only have a few more key leaders that can project a level of charisma and importance to the rest of the movement. But what we're seeing at the local level is that you have these upstart groups in some of these countries. They're not necessarily operationally linked to Al-Qaeda, but there is some ideological affinity. So in some respects, we're sort of returning to what was happening in the 1990s, where there are a lot of localized movements that are focused more on what is going on in their country. And since some of these countries, such as Libya or Egypt or even Tunisia, you know, they're transitioning to a democracy, and these Salafi jihadi individuals don't agree with this type of government, and, you know, they're trying to push forward their vision of what they want, which is a narrow interpretation of Islamic law. Obviously, based on polling and information on these countries, this type of ideas are not too popular. But now that these countries have opened up and are no longer repressed by authoritarian governments, there is now room for these types of individuals to proselytize their ideas, which creates potential problems, as we have seen over the past few days.
And what should be the best response to from the United States to these countries opening up? I mean, Libya is a different story, and we'll talk about that in a moment, because I'm sure that there will be some kind of targeted response to the killing of the ambassador. But what generally should the U.S. be doing to respond to this very different landscape in the Middle East?
Sure. Well, I think what people have to remember is that there are inherent limits to U.S. power, and that we can't control every single situation and what's going on in the Middle East or Asia or Europe or even in our own country for some time. And we also have to understand that now that there are elected officials in these countries, they are beholden to their citizenry and populace. And at least in the case of Egypt, they're a lot more conservative. And as a result, while the Muslim Brotherhood might not be the most popular group, they still, you know, they're beholden to some of these more conservative views on things. This differs from Libya, where they more or less rejected some of the more extremist type of organizations during their elections, and same with Tunisia. But I think it's important to look at each country on a case-by-case basis, and because of these changes in governments, you know, we could be seeing a sort of change in who are our real allies, who are individuals that we sort of are not allies with, but not enemies with. And then potentially, depending on the country, there could be countries that turn into enemies. So.
And what about in the case of Libya? The ambassador to that country, Chris Stevens, was a man who was trying to do the right thing, who, as Hillary Clinton said, risked his life trying to stop a tyrant, gave his life trying to help build a better country. The world needs more people like this. Obviously, the United States isn't going to let this just rest quietly.
No, I mean, and also I think the response from the Libyan government has been positive. I mean, they condemned the attacks, and they said that they're sorry that what occurred. And also, I think the reaction from the average Libyan, too, also suggests that they truly want to build a prosperous society that doesn't have some of these violent extremist problems. You saw demonstrations in Benghazi and Tripoli yesterday with individuals holding a placard, you know, saying that they're sorry and that they couldn't protect Ambassador Stevens and that they were against terrorism and Al-Qaeda and that type of ideology. You juxtapose this to the response in Egypt, and you quickly see that there are major differences in how each government and people have responded, whereas in Egypt you saw the Muslim Brotherhood have a tepid response and more focusing on the film than actually what occurred at the U.S. Embassy. And also the Muslim Brotherhood called for more protests against the film and the insulting of the Muslim prophet Muhammad for this Friday, so tomorrow. So I think these two different reactions sort of show, in some respects, where some of these trajectories of these relations with some of these countries might be going, and some insights into where there are opportunities, which is Libya, and where there's definitely going to be some rough patches and challenges, being Egypt, over the next weeks to months to years.
We'll take phone calls in just a moment here. Our number is 800-486-8655. Aaron Zellin is a fellow at the Washington Institute, a frequent contributor to Foreign Policy, Foreign Affairs, and The Atlantic. And he is the author of the forthcoming study, The State of the Global Jihad Online. Phone calls, welcome. We have one line open at 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org, and the Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program this Thursday, two parts to it. We'll begin with a bi-generational conversation about women in the workplace, and then we'll mark the 10th anniversary of the Peace Learning Center in Milwaukee, teaching young students conflict resolution tools. Two phone calls now for Aaron, and let's start with Muhammad in Madison. Hi, Muhammad.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
I wanted to ask your previous guest this, but I sort of held back, and you used the word right out of the gate, so I'm going to I don't want to put you on the spot, but I mean, what does the word Salafist mean to you?
Based on Islamic tradition, Salaf just means forefathers. So it's, you know, individuals that are trying to emulate the pious predecessors in the 7th century, the first three Muslim generations, including Muhammad's time. And what I mean by Salafists, though, are individuals that then instrumentalize that into a political ideology, not necessarily dealing with the religion as such, but using it and then trying to harness that for political gain.
Well, when it's used, it's very much like, it reminds me of the word Indian, and how, you know, it was misused to describing the Native Americans of this country, but it eventually was accepted, Wahhabi. But, you know, I always wince when I see these terms used, and they're usually used in a pejorative sense because the way you explained it was very excellent. Most Muslims are familiar with the term Salaf, the pious predecessors. But have people that politicize it or make it where it's like something that becomes like an ugly term, that just kind of bothers me. And sometimes it's used without explaining to people, like the vast majority of the audience, when you say Salafist, Wahhabi, they have no idea what you're talking about.
So that was my concern. I agree with you. I think that a lot of the terms that we use in our political discourse are imprecise and also decontextualized in many cases. Unfortunately, these are the terms used that people understand who you're talking about. I guess it would be more precise for me to talk about specific groups in this case, such as, you know, maybe El Nur in Egypt, or, you know, some of the groups in Libya, instead of, you know, this broad stroke term in Salafist, which I sympathize with your statement with regards to that.
Thank you, Muhammad. June and Shano, hi.
Good morning. My question was pretty much answered by the previous caller, but I'd like to ask, if there is, an invisible hand, to use an economic term, that is guiding these Salafic groups, such as Saudi Arabia or Bahrain or some of the states that do have religious and, I don't know the term, but royal, shall we say, leaders.
Well, I don't think any of the particular events that have happened over the last 2 days are guided by any specific country, but we have to understand in the context of the last 30 or 40 years, the Saudi government, as they've gained more wealth through oil, they've helped export some of their ideas through education and religious services in other countries in the region. With that said, though, the specific groups in their countries are operating based on the context that they live in. So if you see, you know, Salafis within Tunisia, they're of a different stripe and have to deal with a different set of conditions there than, say, what you see in Egypt. So I think we have to decouple that while the Saudis might have helped implant some of these ideas, you know, over the past few decades, that doesn't mean that what's going on now is being directed from the House of Saud at all.
Thanks, June, for the call. Our number is 800-486-8655. What do you make? I don't want to spend a lot of time on this because there's so many other issues to talk about, but this issue of politics becoming a part of this, we are, after all, in a presidential race, has become front and center. Should it, Aaron? Does it give us a better understanding of how our presidential candidates would deal with these kinds of issues, or is it a distraction?
I think with issues like this, you know, each party wants to try and get cheap political shots, you know, depending on how the U.S. Embassy in Cairo responded immediately when, you know, there's still a lot of information about what was happening that many didn't even know at the time. And then also how many people have been hitting Mitt Romney for his own response. I think that in crises like these, you know, politics should be set aside. Sure, people want to win elections, but, you know, people are in danger with embassies being breached and consuls being attacked and individuals being killed. And I personally don't think it's a time to be trying to take advantage of a somber and tragic event in that manner.
Aaron, it's been 11 years now since September 11th. How much have we learned? We were so caught off guard and appeared to know so little, except for a handful of Middle East experts. Our diplomats didn't speak the language in many of those areas. It was a learning lesson for most of us as to what was going on. How much have we learned in the last 11 years? Do we understand this part of the world much better? Have we been able to understand the grievances? Do we know how to respond? Have we changed in our response and in our knowledge?
I do think that a lot has changed in the last decade. You know, the level of money that's been poured into programs on Middle East studies as well as Arabic language study has grown exponentially every year mm-hmm. in American universities. So I think you see now a young crop of individuals who are in their early to mid to late 20s, even early 30s now, that really have a great understanding. And I think that this sort of trickles upwards. While some of these individuals might not have, you know, important jobs at this point, their understanding of the region helps out individuals that they work with that might be a, you know, a scholar or a diplomat or somebody like that, because many of these individuals not only have studied the religion, the culture, and the language, but they've also gone over there and lived there. You know, I mean, in my case, I lived in Egypt and Morocco, and that really helped me better understand those two societies and some of the general ideas of what's been going on in those societies over the past, you know, few decades.
Yes. Ted in New Berlin is next. Hi, Ted.
Hi. Morning. A question for your guest. Does he think that the U.S. drone attacks in Yemen and other countries, which sort of violate the sovereignty of those countries and include collateral damage, have severely hurt the U.S. and Arab countries?
Well, I think that the case of Yemen is interesting because unlike Pakistan, where we haven't seen too much of a backlash per se, there seems to be more hostility to it in Yemen. Part of it has to do with many individuals being killed that are innocent. I'm not sure that it necessarily breaks the sovereignty of the other country, since the government of Yemen is allowing it. The problem with that, though, is that some of these governments are not beholden to their people, and they're not democratically elected. You know, so I think that there are definitely some questions there, and I do think that some of these drone strikes have definitely inflamed some individuals, but you haven't seen in a large-scale outcry in the way we've seen in the past few days over other related events to this film. So that would suggest to me that while individuals do not like the drone strikes, they aren't angry at them as much as, say, you know, a film that you know, is having a negative voice against the Muslim prophet Muhammad.
Thanks for the call. One more call. We'll just have to make it short, and we go to Kyle and Stoughton quickly.
Anyway,
please.
So yeah, may I...
I'm sorry, you're not there. Let's go to Tim in Ashland. Hi, Tim.
Hi. I was curious what his opinion would be. Would it behoove the United States to help, not covertly but not overtly, with intelligence to track down the people and then let the Libyan government, you know, arrest them and try them? Would that help us? With
all right. We have about 20 seconds. Aaron?
Yeah, I definitely think that that's what the United States is actually aiming to do. While there have been reports that they're using drones for surveillance, it is believed that they'll then use that intelligence to pass it on to the Libyan authorities so that they can seek their own justice.
Aaron, thank you so much for being with us. Aaron Zellin, fellow at the Washington Institute, he writes for a number of publications and is doing a study right now, soon to be released, The State of the Global Jihad Online. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and Brett Jaspers, who produced this program, and thanks for all of your calls. We will continue, of course. This will be an issue as the days go on, so we'll be doing more. Please stay tuned. A very interesting hour is ahead. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.